Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski, bringing us the news. So I'll just give a quick introduction to the program and then I'll turn it over to Carl. We are going to be speaking today at about quarter after with Dr. Linda Burke, who is a feminist biologist. She's written a number of different books. Most recently, she co-authored a book called The Sacrifice: How Scientific Experiments Transform Animals and People. Linda Burke is a huge name in animal studies, within biology, within feminist theory circles. To say that this is a big honor and a thrill to talk with her is really an understatement. I'm totally psyched for this upcoming interview. But before we do that, over to you, Carl.
So I'd just like to remind people, I made this announcement for the past couple weeks, but We would like to remind people that tomorrow, Wednesday, November 21st, is the talk with Jonathan Balcombe. He's talking about his book, Pleasurable Kingdom, which we've actually talked about on the show, and Lauren has interviewed him. He's going to be talking at OISE, the Ontario Institute for something that I can't remember right now. It's the OISE building. It's at St. George Station. The talk is happening at 7 p.m. I believe tickets are $10 in advance or $12 at the door. And members of the Animal Voices Facebook group get to go for free. So good incentive to join our group. We get some good perks. In the news today, I caught this first story from CBC News, and I thought it was really, really interesting that they were actually willing to talk about this. I mean, they're talking about it in a particular way, but regardless, the headline is, "The Broiler Chicken Celebrates a Finger-Lickin' Golden Anniversary." And again, this is coming from CBC News. Researchers at the University of Alberta are organizing a birthday party for a genetic strain of broiler chicken they preserved 50 years ago to ensure it lived on amid the evolution of its monster cousins. Quote, "At the time, it was thought by Agriculture Canada that genetic progress was happening pretty quickly and that a random bred standard should be maintained to preserve those genetics," unquote, said Doug Corver, professor of poultry nutrition at the University of Alberta. "Chickens currently sold in grocery stores have gone through extensive gene selection to boost their size and company profits," said Martin Zuidoff, a poultry research scientist. "Plump broiler chickens are prized for their tenderness and most commonly roasted in home kitchens and fried in fast food restaurants. Birds raised from the strain saved in 1957 are 5 times smaller than today's commercially grown chickens. But researchers believe it's critical to save genes from the 1957 chickens for food security in case of illness that could threaten the existence of lines developed over the past 50 years. Quote, "If we ever have to fall back on some traits that have been lost in the commercial genetic selection process, then we have that resource available to us to rely on again," Zuidoff told CBC News. "A private party on Tuesday in Edmonton will bring together the group of geneticists who decided to save the strain in 1957. Corver and Zuidoff have created a birthday treat for the research chickens, a special feed for the day topped off with birthday candles." And moving on from that, the next story is coming to us from The Times Online in the UK. Catnapping outcry after fur traders admit buying animals killed in Britain. Cat fur is reputed to be good for rheumatism. The disappearance of hundreds of household cats have sparked calls for an official inquiry amid fears that they could have been killed, skinned, and turned into blankets. Concern has been fueled by the existence of a legal Swiss trade in cat fur, which is reputed to be good for rheumatism. But cat blanket retailers have denounced allegations of widespread catnapping across the border in France as absurd. They insist that they buy skins from wild felines killed in Switzerland and Britain. Patricia Dolciani, head of the French Society for the Protection of Animals, or the SPA, in Thonon-les-Bains in the Alps, has called on the gendarmerie to launch an investigation. She says that her team has registered the disappearance of at least 550 cats in the region so far this year, more than double the number for the whole of 2006. "What really raised our suspicions was when people started ringing to say that they had lost more than one cat. One person near Megève, for instance, lost 3 in a day." Quote, "It's quite possible to lose a cat, of course, they can get run over, but 3 in the same day, in the same place, in the same family is more suspicious." The sense of panic gripping pet owners in the Alps was heightened when Marcel Marchand, who has a refuge for wild cats, found one of her animals caught in a trap. Albert Vercoletti was not so lucky. Both his cats, Marx and Lisa, disappeared from his alpine chalet. He said, "We're sad and unhappy. We don't know what happened to them." One theory put forward by the SPA is that the pets have fallen victim to traffickers feeding the fur trade on the other side of the border. Quote, "You're allowed to kill cats and sell their fur in Switzerland, unlike France," said Mr. Dolciani. So perhaps that's where the cats are ending up. We don't know. They might be taken to laboratories who want to experiment on live animals or for other reasons. We don't know. But it's important that there's an investigation so that the authorities can carry out a thorough investigation of the records of Swiss tanneries. Swiss media say that thousands of cat fur blankets are made every year, and almost all are sold to people suffering from rheumatism. Sylviane Gelmini, who sells cat blankets at her shop in Yvonand, is in the Vaud district, told the Times, quote, "I'm totally mystified by these accusations. The cat fur trade is small and not very lucrative, and I really can't see why traffickers would want to get involved. I sell 10 blankets a year, and all to people in pain with rheumatism. When these allegations broke, I phoned my wholesalers, and they said they'd never heard of anyone trafficking cats between France and Switzerland. One told me his supplier was in Switzerland, and the other said it was in England. Swiss tanneries say that the trafficking claims have been propagated by animal rights activists in France as part of a campaign to ban the cat fur trade. But Tommy Tomek, founder of SOS Chat, a Swiss cat protection association, said that she had contacted a tannery pretending to be a customer. The owner said that he had about 100 furs in stock and sent her 3. He told me they were wild cats killed by hunters or peasants. But if that's the case, where were the bullet holes? And finally, coming to us from a website, scoop.co.nz, this is a media release from the Animal Liberation Front, who rescued ducks from farm factory misery on Sunday, the 17th of November, 2007. Auckland Animal Action has anonymously received footage highlighting the cruel and inhumane conditions that ducks suffer on factory farms and slaughterhouses throughout New Zealand. The footage obtained follows the ducks from hatchlings to slaughter. During this time, the birds can be seen suffering from ammonia burns, overcrowding, and eye infections due to a lack of water. At the slaughterhouse, the footage documents workers punching a bird, attempting to kick another, and slitting one's throat with what appears to be a hose end. The ducks enter the farm at a few days old and reach slaughter weight by week 6. By this time, there is very little room for the birds to move. This overcrowding causes them much stress. The duck's excrement is left to build up over this time and reaches a toxic level, causing severe ammonia burns to the ducks. The spokeswoman for Auckland Animal Action, Callie Sandbrook, says, "As aquatic birds, water is of the utmost importance to ducks, who would naturally spend upwards of 75% of their day swimming, eating, and socializing in the water. However, on factory farms, ducks cannot even fully immerse their heads in water, which leads to eye infections and sometimes blindness." Mrs. Sandbrook says, "We are extremely pleased to hear that 30 ducks have been spared this life of misery and an untimely death and can now live free, fulfilling lives. We recognize the government's failure to prevent such cruelty and understand that by putting economics first, the government has left compassionate people no choice but to take direct action to save lives." And the anonymous communique in full says this: "Over the past few months, we have documented the cruel conditions which ducks are forced to endure on factory farms in Aotearoa. During our investigation, 30 beautiful ducks have been rescued and are now free to spend the rest of their natural life playing in the water where they belong. Sadly, the thousands we left behind will have long been murdered, packaged, and shipped off to be consumed. Like other factory-farmed animals, ducks are not treated as thinking, feeling beings, but as commodities to be turned into profit. For the short 6 weeks of their lives, they are crammed into overcrowded, filthy sheds, where they are deprived of water to bathe in, nesting material, and the ability to display their natural behaviors and social patterns. The suffering and cruelty these animals are forced to endure is legitimized by the state. We do not respect a legal system that puts economics before the preservation of life. We are only concerned with what is right. We stand in solidarity with our comrades worldwide to fight for an earth free from oppression. Until every shed is empty, we will not rest. The ALF." And that's the news.
Thanks, Carl. You're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. If you're just tuning in, that was Carl Orzechowski bringing us the news. Today we are going to be speaking with the much-esteemed author and academic activist, Dr. Linda Burke, who is currently working part-time the anthrozoology unit in the biology department at the University of Chester in the UK. And Linda Burke was also the senior lecturer in women and gender studies at the University of Warwick in the UK. She's the author of many different books, including the 2007 text, The Sacrifice, How Scientific Experiments Transform Animals and People, as well as texts such as Feminism and the Biological Body, Feminism, Animals, and Science, The Naming of the Shrew, among others. And today we're going to be speaking about her academic legacy and about a little bit about her personal journey with some of the issues around feminism and biology. So, Dr. Linda Burke, thank you for being on the program today.
Thanks for inviting me.
I have to say, I've been doing this radio program now for about 7 years, and I don't get nervous too much anymore, but I'm kind of nervous for this interview because I've been reading you for about a decade now.
So why does that make you nervous?
Well, it's just, I mean, you're just such a huge name in so many of the different fields. I was first introduced to your work when I was doing my undergrad in women's studies, and then I went on to do a master's in environmental studies, and I'm currently finishing up my PhD in environmental studies. So you've been there the whole way along for all the different things that I've studied. So I just want to say thank you again so much for not only being on the program, but for the tremendous contribution that you've made.
Well, I'm glad it's been useful.
Yes, it certainly has. So let's start off with that trinity, I guess, that you've put together in a book, Animal Science and Feminism, those three together. Can you tell us about how you ended up putting those different themes in conversation in your work?
Well, I guess, first of all, when I was very, very young, I just always loved animals. Well, I love biology. I think I also like plants, too. You know, anything that's living is fascinating to me, but we had animals, like most kids. I had dogs around. I had horses around. Well, I guess they were ponies then. And I was just endlessly fascinated by them. I wanted to become a scientist from when I was quite young. I think that was the influence of science fiction on the television and my dad, who was very keen on science. And I kind of grew up with some sort of sense of injustice, which I think partly came from knowing that nasty things were done to animals. But then as I grew up, I extrapolated that and realized that it wasn't just animals, of course. There were an awful lot of humans that were being oppressed and were suffering. And, of course, that included women. So that kind of put those three in conversation, at least in my head. But putting them into conversation in practice is, of course, a lot harder. And the trajectory is that although I was fascinated about animals and by animals, I was always nervous about doing biology, because of course it has traditionally always involved things like dissection, and I agonized over that, but in the end I kept coming back to doing biology just because of the fascination with animals. And I, in the end, as you know, that I did my PhD in animal behavior, because A, that didn't involve me doing terribly nasty things to animals, but also it meant I was studying them directly.
Were you ever in a position then where you had to do something that you felt compromised your beliefs?
Sure. And sometimes you cop out, basically. I mean, I remember an undergraduate practical session where we first had to kill the frog by sticking a needle into its brain. I couldn't personally do it. Now, that's a cop-out because I still use the frog. But I couldn't personally do it. And it was that, the sort of emotional reaction to that, that's made me so aware of how so many people, young people, go into doing biology for the same reasons as I did, a love of nature. And yet you end up having to do things which destroy the very spirit of that nature in the process. And that dilemma has been with me ever since.
In the press release that I put out, and I know that you've used this expression too about the rhetoric of science, and I think for some people that might seem like a strange idea at all, that what does rhetoric have to do with science? The idea that, you know, the situation that you were confronted with the frog would be part of a set of discourses or ideas about who animals are and who science is and all that kind of thing. Can you tell us a bit more about how you see sciences as a set of rhetorics, I suppose, or different discourses, as well as, you know, the sort of more material stuff that people think of when they think of science as this kind of objective set of facts?
Yeah. Well, of course, it is partly. It's about trading in fact. But, and I think the popular idea of science, as well as indeed the way I was brought up, was that, you know, that you're uncovering some sort of truth. But that for a long time now, there's been increasing critique about the idea that we can't produce knowledge without who we are coming into it. And so the position that we are in, and for me that's white middle class European, amongst other things, woman, the position that you are in inevitably has something to bear on the kind of work that you do. It might be a question of it influences the kinds of questions that you might ask. It might influence how you interpret material. It might influence how you do the experiments, whatever. A whole load of different things that can bring to bear on the kinds of questions we ask of or about nature. The discourses of the wider culture about how we relate to other animals, for instance, inevitably come into and shape the way that we do science and the way that, and the discourses of science. And of course, in the wider culture, non-human animals in general, partly through the Judeo-Christian tradition, have been treated as our property. We have dominion over them, in biblical terms. And so that's part of our heritage. So, you know, we can always justify the things that we do to animals.
People often talk about the need to strive for objectivity, that science, you know, they might acknowledge, well, there's been these problems, there's been this problem in the past or this problem in the past. And the idea is that we can somehow get around it by always striving for objectivity, that if we just have more objectivity in science, then we have a better science. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, objectivity has come in for a lot of criticism in feminist critiques of science. I don't think we should seek to lose it. You know, I think seeking after some sort of objectivity is important because it's seeking after something which says, okay, I think this is an agreed truth that we can actually arrive at a consensus here. That's what we're trying to seek rather than simply my opinion or your opinion or somebody else's opinion. In that sense of objectivity, I think that's desirable. But if we believe, by using the word objectivity, that we can stand outside of nature, pretend we're merely a dispassionate observer, then I think that's dangerous, because we never can be. And, of course, you know, working with animal behaviour, that's very clear. Sure, you can try and make it as, quote-unquote, objective as you like, but as you can by, for example, using film, but still you have made some intervention in the life of that animal, which is going to have an impact on it and its subsequent experiences, and most importantly on its behaviour while you're observing it. So you never can stand outside of the nature that you're observing.
You mentioned feminist critiques then, as you're elaborating on, of objectivity. Can you talk a bit more? I know that in Feminism, Animals, and Science, and elsewhere, you've rhetorically asked the question, but are these feminist questions? Can you talk about how your work in biology is informed by feminism? Why does biology in particular, or the sciences more generally, what does this have to do with feminism?
Well, several ways. First of all, part of what biology does is to create definitions of what nature is, including what bodies are. And so insofar as it has things to say about what a female body is or what a male body is, then clearly biology has things to say that are relevant to feminism. But the wider critique about objectivity is relevant because objectivity is culturally has tended to be associated with masculinity. Now, as soon as you say that, one of the dangers is that people start immediately to think that what you're saying is that it's therefore the preserve of men. Now, that's not true. What I'm saying is that it is associated with that quality that we like to call masculinity or best quality. And it's that association between masculinity and objectivity that makes it a problem, and so it makes it something that feminists ought to be thinking about. And one of the things that I mentioned in Feminism, Animals and Science was precisely that sense that when I was growing up, we were told that we should be very objective, we should not allow our emotions about animals to come, or dissection, to come into what we did. That's still around today, but I think it's a little bit more tempered now. And of course that is a stance in the teaching of biology which is implicitly gendered. It does position women kind of, either you accept it or you get out of biology. Well, it positions anyone, but the fact that it carries this sort of subordinate message about gender is a problem, I think. And it's certainly a feminist question.
And what about the reverse, then? Do you think that biology has something important to say back to feminism? I know that these realms aren't as discreet as I'm making them sound here, but in what ways do you see biology being important to feminism, which has, as you pointed out...
Yeah, but the problem is that necessarily we've had to spend an awful lot of time and energy refuting very naive claims of biological determinism which are prevalent in the wider culture. By that I mean the idea that, for instance, there is a gene which makes women more nurturant or some such, or that your hormones do, or I've come across the claim that because of something, I think it was something still on the X chromosome, but anyway, something biological, women were better at ironing. If you ever saw my clothes, you'd know what load of rubbish that was. So it's that sort of claim that is always around in the wider culture. And so that in itself just makes biology relevant to feminism, because we have to constantly rebut those sorts of arguments. But the other thing is that there is growing interest in feminist inquiry about how we think about the body. Well, of course, the body is, it may be many things, but it is partly biological. So we should be paying attention to that aspect of what biology is. Plus, the other thing is that, of course, now it's probably true to say that about 50% of undergraduates are in biology are women, probably even more than that. Although when you get to the upper echelons of research, the proportion of women drops away, as usual. And it's been one of the important tenets of feminist critiques of science over many decades that we need to get more women in science, because they may well have a different standpoint and therefore bring something valuable to science in general.
People within feminist theory, I think there has been a tendency, this is shifting now, but to want to distance themselves from ideas about the body that have been oppressive, and really the idea of the body has been bound up with the idea of the animal as well, and so there's been this tendency to want to distance oneself from the body and the animal kind of simultaneously. Can you talk about that? Why has there been that resistance and that tendency to distance from the animal body, the so-called animal body?
Well, there's a couple of layers here, so let me deal with the animal bit from that first. I mean, the first thing, as I've said, is the association with biological determinism. Feminists have been a bit wary of that for understandable reasons. The second, of course, is that, within our culture in the West, and in English particularly, we tend to use subordinate words so that women are associated with the bestial. And although derogatory words are used about men, they're often ambiguously derogatory, like stud, for instance. Whereas women are called words which tend to have very, very negative connotations, which are animal words. So it's not surprising that the women's movement has tried to distance itself from any concept of the animal. We try to distance ourselves from anything that seems to be in nature, because that seems to be fixed. And I think that's one of the problems for me, is that it ties into a widespread cultural belief that the behaviour of humans, we have free will, and the behaviour of non-humans is somehow fixed, determined by biology. And I think that's a very dangerous dichotomy. I say dangerous because I think that as long as you've got that dichotomy, someone somewhere will always use animal behaviour badly as a model for human behaviour. But what we can say about that is that it's actually a very false dichotomy, because the behaviour of a great many animals, and we must be careful about using the generic here, some kinds of animals, are not at all fixed into genes or whatever. Certainly we know that the behaviour of the great apes, virtually all primates, indeed probably a great many of the mammals, is very, very sensitive to their environment. They learn quickly. They're a lot more clever than we used to think they are. And so any notion that a particular kind of animal's behaviour is fixed into biology should be challenged all the time. And so that wariness that feminists have had about being linked to animals should be challenged on many fronts, because what is it that we are wary of? It's a kind of animal I don't recognise, if you like. It's one that's terribly fixed, and I actually don't think that the behaviour of many of the animals that we're familiar with, the animals that we might live with, for instance, which is usually mammals, I don't think that's fixed into hormonal determinism or genetic determinism at all, or hardly not to the extent that we think it is.
I'd like to move into some of the specific research that you've done on animal behavior and researching hormones, but I also want to hear about the critiques of your work, some of the major challenges that you face within the academy, and what are those voices saying about your work?
Well, I think when I was doing the research in hormones and behavior, which I did years ago, I think there were people around in my department who felt that I couldn't do objective science because I was a feminist. So you get that kind of thing. I think I have many answers to that. Not all of them are things that I'd like to say on air.
Okay.
you know, I just ignored them and I just carried on. I think, and since then, of course, there's been a number of people who generally criticise feminist critics of science. As part of what was called the science wars, you know, the so-called attacks on rationality. I don't believe for a moment that feminists are attacking rationality. I think we're complementing it, so I would continue to stand by that kind of position and continue to do the same work. That doesn't bother me anymore. There are enough people who do take feminist input seriously, and they're, you know, throughout sociology and the humanities. And I think that there are enough people now in science who are willing to accept that there are reasons to take on board the influence of society, if you like.
You've been doing this work for many decades now, and
yeah.
I mean, one of the things that struck me when I was looking back over the many things that you've written and you're still writing today is there is this incredible sense that you obviously have been a groundbreaker, and there's so many more voices now saying, I think, things that harmonize with your perspective. But
yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk more about, I guess, what you were just touching on now, about how things are changing and what patterns or turns you see in the fields that you've been engaging with over these many years.
Well, one of the things that's happened, and which I think is wonderful, is that within ethology, animal behaviour, which is my parent's discipline, if you like, my original discipline, there's been a lot more awareness in the last couple of decades on animal cognition and animal emotions. And also, there, in concordance with that, there's been an awareness that we should pay less attention to the criticisms of anthropomorphism. I was raised not to be anthropomorphic, never to attribute to animals human emotions and so on. And my answer to that was then, and still is, why not? Because that's precisely what we do with other people. We give them the benefit of the doubt, that we know what they're thinking, or that we can empathize with them, and they can empathize with us. So why can't we assume that as a starting point for other animals? And I think that one of the things that's been happening in the last few years has indeed been a much greater awareness of animals' abilities, and indeed emotions. And one of the groundbreakers there, of course, is Mark Beckhoff in Colorado. I think his work is wonderful.
We've had him on the program, and he was fantastic. Can you speak then to your research on animal behavior and hormones? Can you take us through that?
It was quite a long time ago now, but I'll do my best.
Okay.
I was interested in how hormones affect behavior. I was also interested in the feminist rejection of that idea, because, of course, nobody ever questioned, they still don't, the notion that hormones affect bodies. Of course they affect bodies. Most women throughout most of their lives menstruate, and nobody says, well, hormones are not affecting the uterus. Of course it is. Of course they are. So there is always a possibility that hormones affect behaviour of any of us. The question is how much, and it's interesting, isn't it? Even I say that. In non-human animals as well, you have to understand it in a context. It's not simply that if there is a hormonal change, it determines the behavioural outcome. It affects the behavioural outcome in a context. And what one of the things we were interested in was looking at hormones in very early life, which, affect sex differences. But part of the way that that's mediated is through the mother. If you're talking about rats, for instance, which we were looking at, then any differences in the hormone levels in the pup is picked up by the mother, and she reacts differently to them. So can you say, therefore, that any sex differences when those pups become adults are down to hormonal differences when they were in their brains or whatever, or is it partly due to how the mother reacted to them? You can't untangle that. And I think that's one of the things that we have to remember, that whatever species we're talking about, hormones, any part of biology, is acting in a particular context. And what we do when we study animals in the lab is, of course, we impoverish the context. We control the variables, we put them in cages and so on, and we take them into a context in which only certain kinds of behavior are possible.
I remember reading, I think it was Temple Grandin, saying that when you study an animal in a lab, you think that you're studying the animal, but what you are is studying the animal in the lab.
Absolutely. It took people who were looking at rats a long time to realize that, what they were calling sex differences in sexual behavior was profoundly affected by the constraints of the testing apparatus. Female rats in the wild actually do a lot of sort of come-on behavior, if you like, but they need a lot of space to do it in. If you put them into very constrained cages, then they can't do that, and of course it looks like effectively like rape. But they don't do that in the wild.
Right. I mean, this brings us exactly where I wanted to take the interview, is to talk about the 2007 text, The Sacrifice, How Scientific Experiments Transform Animals and People, which you co-authored with a couple of other researchers.
Yeah.
What contribution do you feel that text makes in particular? I know that you've been interested in looking at ideas about who lab animals are, and also the different identities, not just lab animals, but also those who do the experiments, the public, animal rights activists, etc.
Well, this is based on some research that we did, Mike Michael and I did in the UK, and Arnie Arlouk did in the United States, on interviewing scientists who were working with animals. I mean, what kind of strategies do they use to deal with the dilemma? Because although, inevitably, and of course, the anti-vivisectionist organizations have to see the scientists as being somehow ignoring animal pain and suffering. But what happens is that as you go through biological training, there are lots of processes whereby you have to learn to suppress emotional reactions to the animals and learn to become enculturated, if you like, into the cultures of science. You have to learn to accept it. And so, of course, there are traces of that. If you talk to working scientists, they might tell you, well, I can do such and such with mice, but I certainly couldn't do it with primates. They will always find ways to draw the line somewhere. Of course, there are going to be some exceptions or really extreme, but most scientists don't feel, really, if you push them, don't feel comfortable with using animals. But for them, the greater moral consideration is whether or not their research is going to lead to some medical breakthrough. They have a different moral cut-off point, if you like, from their critics. So what we were doing with the book was to put together that research and look at how the people who are in and around the animal experimentation controversy talk about the animals that they use and talk about the controversy. What kinds of positions do they take?
Where can that take us? Why is that important to understand those narratives?
Well, I think it's important because, we get stuck in the controversy about vivisection because it's always exactly, you know exactly what each side are going to say. What never gets said is that animal research is how it happened historically. It has contributed to what I know, for instance, or what I've learned about how the physiology of the body works. That's true. You know, I can't deny that everything I learned was based on animal bodies and horribly nasty things happening to them. What never gets asked is what it might have looked like if we hadn't had that assumption that we could use animals. And so if you get, for instance, the scientific community defending research will say, oh, well, look at all these breakthroughs. Well, we don't know what we'd have found out if we hadn't had the animals to work on, if we'd have used a more holistic approach to human biology or whatever. And, of course, the anti-vivisectionists say that there's been no useful knowledge. Well, that's not true either, because we do know that we've had a lot of knowledge that has been based on animals. Some of it isn't useful in the sense that rather little of the research that is done in specific areas that's used with some kind of justification with reference to medicine, very little of that actually feeds through into clinical trials. I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, there was what they called a meta-analysis published in the British Medical Journal, and what they were looking at was the correlation between clinical studies of two or three particular instances. One of them was heart disease, if I remember rightly, and how much of the original animal work was actually cited usefully in the clinical stuff. And the answer is very little. So I think both sides need to think about what's being said, rather than just, you know, this kind of knee-jerk reaction. So I think what I would like to think that our work would be to kind of open that up and get people thinking a little bit more about why they're saying what they're saying, instead of this constant, like we're right, you're wrong. Mm. It doesn't get us anywhere, that kind of positioning.
Do you have any suggestions about what this might mean practically for activism?
That's very difficult. For the time being, as far as I can see in the foreseeable future, that animals are going to be used. I don't like it. I hate it. But I can't see a way around it, because that's the kind of structure of the science that we have. Some activists clearly do want to do the breaking into laboratories, the illegal actions. I'm ambivalent about that, I have to say. I certainly don't like violent actions. And I'm not entirely happy with releasing animals into the wild, because a lot of these lab-bred animals don't cope very well when they're let out. I know some people believe strongly that that's what should happen, but I'm saying personally I'm ambivalent about that. But I do think that the anti-vivisectionist organisations do have a strong card to play. They do have a role to play in the debate. And, you know, here in England, they've pushed hard to to get the law changed. Now, you know, according to them, they haven't succeeded very much in changing it. The law to the scientists got stronger in 1986 when the newish, by now, Act came in. But the anti-vivisection organisations were very strong in trying to push for change. Okay, they may not have got the strength of the changes they wanted, but, you know, some people would say that we have the toughest legislation in the world in Britain that it, in theory, controls what scientists can do. I say in theory, I'm well aware that a lot of people think that it doesn't do that in practice. But. Mm-hmm.
I know that this book, this was The Sacrifice, came out in 2007, and these have obviously these are still questions that you're writing about and thinking about. But I know that you're also involved with a whole set of other ideas as well. I know that they overlap, but I was wondering if you could talk about some of the questions that you find most compelling right now. Where has your mind and your heart been lately? Around animals and science.
Having grown up with horses, never left them. You know, despite my mother being told I'd grow out of it one day, I never did. And now I'm doing research on horses. We're interested in the impact of, this is the straight animal behaviour bit. We're interested in how human behaviour affects horse behaviour and what the implications of that might be for their welfare, because there's a lot of people getting into horses who never grew up with them and aren't very used to behaving around them. And of course, if you don't get it right, there are problems for the welfare of the animal, there are problems for human safety. These are big animals. And I've also been doing some work on, because I can't leave the social studies of science stuff behind, I'm doing some work on horse, what you might call horse cultures as well. The horse-human relationship in general is basically what I'm interested in now. It's a bit of a shift from the feminist questions, I guess, but mm-hmm. There's still some gender issues in there as well, and I'm still doing some work on feminism and science in general.
Would you say then that it sounds like those personal relationships that you've had with animals have clearly influenced how you do your work and how you think about animals?
Profoundly. Every day I go out and I talk to the horses or I talk to the dogs, and I think, you know, it's understanding that this is another being that is much more intelligent than our culture gives it credit for, I should say him or her credit for, and that it's awe-inspiring, the way in which they put up with what we humans throw at them, and the immense amount of love and compassion, as well as intelligence, that they can direct at us.
We only have about 5 more minutes left, and the hour always goes so quickly. I would love to keep talking with you. I just want to say this has just been a hugely important interview for me, and I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule, but I wanted to just turn it over to you if you have any closing thoughts you wanted to share with our listeners.
Only this, that, you know, at my age, I'm now late middle age, and I've seen some social changes in my time, and I know I've been part of some of those social changes around feminism, the lesbian movement, and so on. And it's one thing that I think that, you know, I'm mostly an academic. I have stood on demonstrations and so forth, but these days mostly I just do it academically. But the fact remains that I do think that intellectual work has a part to play in changing public opinion or in moving with public opinion, and the more that we can do on challenging pre-existing ideas about the inferiority of other animals, the better. And I'm really proud to be part of that movement that kind of started. So now we have a serious academic study of the human-animal relationship, and I think that has a very important part to play alongside the activism.
Can I ask you, just to close then, who some of your, where you find inspiration right now, you know, aside from the animals in your life?
Oh, what do you mean aside from? That's what I was going to say. Yeah, my animals, of course, mostly. I think that there are some important people writing out there. We've mentioned Mark Beckhoff, whose work I admire greatly, and Donna Haraway, of course, mm-hmm. In feminist writing. She now writes a lot about animals. I think I admire anyone who wants to write about an area which is so interdisciplinary that it often gets challenged in the academy because it doesn't fit into neat categories of sociology or whatever. And there are more and more of us out there, and I think it is challenging intellectual thought, and hopefully that's spilling out into the wider culture. That's what I really hope.
Dr. Linda Burke, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's been a great pleasure.
And for me.
Bye for now.
Okay, bye.
We were just speaking with Dr. Linda Burke. That will go down for me as one of my most favorite interviews of all time. That was awesome to get to speak with her. I would definitely encourage anybody to check out her work. She's been writing on these issues for many years. She's an extremely brilliant, very accessible writer. Lots of really interesting things to say. She's definitely challenged me on many different fronts throughout the year. It was really cool to talk with her. Again, her books, Feminism, Animals, and Science, The Naming of the Shrew, that's an older book, but the one that just came out is called The Sacrifice, How Scientific Experiments Transform Animals and People. I can't wait to read that book. I'm sure it will be excellent. I guess I should mention, again, our website, animalvoices.ca. This interview will be archived within about a week's time. We have 216 programs currently on the website that you can download for free, so you can go and check it out. Again, animalvoices.ca. We'd really appreciate if you vote for us on Podcast Alley. We are a live radio show, obviously, but we do have a life as a podcast, and we would love it if you gave us some free advertising, help bump our standing or ranking on Podcast Alley, get the word out there. You can just go to Podcast Alley and cue in Animal Voices and cast your vote or say something nice.
And come join us on Facebook.
Come join us on Facebook.
Play us in Scrabble.
Don't play us in
no,
Scrabble,
don't.
Actually.
I've got too many games going right now.
If you're a MySpace fan, too, we also have a MySpace. You can go to myspace.com, Animal Voices, check us out there. And I just want to give the email again. It's animalvoices@gmail.com. If you have any questions or comments for the show, any comments really are welcome. So please do let us know what you think of the programming, what you think of the new website. Maybe you can light a fire under us to get off our butts and do the newsletter, which has been coming down the pipe for a while.
But if you sign up for the mailing list, you will get the weekly updates on what's going to be on the show.
Do you want to tell us about the next program?
Coming up next will be Sergio Emir and his wonderful show, Dos Mundos.
He was an expert right from the beginning. I was so jealous. I started listening to the program right when he started, and I thought, this is really unfair. He's so smooth. Right from the beginning.
Some people just got it.
He's got it. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Animal Voices. Thanks for tuning in.